Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the program, we have stories from Christopher Jones Cruz and Dan Friedel. We also hear from Brian Lynn and Ashley Thompson. And as always, we finish the show with our weekly American Stories program. Today, we hear the final part of The Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe.
A former acting director of the Central Intelligence Agency recently spoke to VOA about the killing of Kim Jong-nam in Malaysia. He said the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was murdered to stop any effort to remove the current leadership of the country. 45-year-old Kim Jong-nam died on February 13th. Malaysian officials say two women poisoned him at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport in Malaysia. Police say the women put VX nerve agent on Kim's face. Police in Kuala Lumpur arrested the women last month. A North Korean official suggested that Kim Jong-nam died of a heart attack. Malaysia's national police chief said that was not the case, according to police experts. The South Korean government has accused the North Korean leader of ordering the killing of his half-brother. John McLaughlin was the acting director of the CIA from July to September 2004, and the deputy director from 2000 to 2004. He worked at the CIA for 30 years. He says North Korea likely planned and carried out the attack because of the method used by the women.
It's very hard for someone not connected to a state entity, a nation state, to obtain the kind of poison that was apparently used.
At one time, Kim Jong-nam was believed to be the choice of former North Korean leader Kim Jong-il to rule the country. Kim Jong-il was the leader of North Korea from 1994 until he died in 2011. Kim Jong-nam has lived outside of North Korea since 2001. McLaughlin now teaches at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He told VOA that the reason Kim Jong-nam was killed was the North Korean leadership wanted to make sure there is not an alternative readily available to replace Kim Jong-un. McLaughlin said the North particularly would want to make sure that China would not have someone handy that they could install in the event Kim Jong-un was removed or fell from power. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
The Library of Congress is using technology to make its collections available to people across the United States and around the world. The library is the main research center of the United States Congress. It has books, recordings, photographs, and newspapers. The library also has maps, sheet music, and even baseball cards among its collections. It is the largest library in the world. 5 months ago, President Barack Obama named Carla Hayden as Librarian of Congress. She is both the first woman and the first African American to be appointed to the position. Most who held the job before her were politicians or came from the world of education. But Hayden has worked as a librarian. She led a large library in Baltimore, Maryland. Before that, she served as chief librarian for the public library in Chicago, Illinois. She was also president of the American Library Association. The Library of Congress has been criticized in recent years for a lack of leadership and for being slow to accept new technologies. The library was created more than 200 years ago as a place where members of Congress could find information. Its workers also provide research for U.S. lawmakers and their aides. Today, the Library of Congress is considered America's library. It has more than 160 million items. They include more than 30 million books and print materials from around the world in more than 450 languages. The library also has a Gutenberg Bible produced in the 1400s and the world's largest comic book collection. Hayden says the library adds at least 10,000 items to its collections every workday. The general public can see materials in the library's reading rooms, but is not permitted to take them off the grounds. Hayden wants to change that by making them available online and through other technologies. Hayden says she wants the library to open its arms to people around the world, to let people know it is available to them.
We have things on our website that bring the collections to people wherever they are. They can download materials, they can participate, and we just had, and this is pretty exciting, a 3D virtual reality tour where you can put the goggles on and you can physically tour the buildings.
Hayden also wants the Library of Congress to make its materials available across the country through traveling demonstrations.
Actually taking an 18-wheeler truck and loading it up with facsimiles. Sometimes there'll be electronic information and devices on those trucks and actually going into communities.
I'm Katie Weaver.
One of the most popular events in Washington, D.C. each year is the National Cherry Blossom Festival. It takes place in early April. People from around the world come to see the beautiful pink and white blossoms on almost 1,700 flowering cherry trees. The city's first cherry trees were a gift from Japan to the United States in 1912. About 100 of them are still alive. They are planted in southwest Washington, along the Potomac River, and a body of water called the Tidal Basin. The cherry trees are a short walk from a number of major monuments, like the Lincoln Memorial, Jefferson Memorial, and Washington Monument. Over 1 million people travel to Washington each year to see the trees. However, there is a small problem. The weather in Washington has been unusually warm the past few weeks. On March 1st, the temperature rose to about 27 degrees Celsius. Small buds can already be seen on the cherry trees. These growths will turn into flowers sooner than usual. In fact, this may be the earliest year ever for cherry blossoms. Experts say the trees will look their best between March 14th and March 17th. The U.S. National Park Service says that may break the record of March 15th, set in 1990. Many people would like to see the blossoms come later. One Facebook user says Washington needs a break from large crowds. Jack Potter wrote, "We just had the inauguration. We don't need more tourists." Twitter user April Wolf is worried that the early bloom is evidence of climate change. She wrote, "I want to like this because who doesn't like cherry blossoms? But then I think, climate change." The cherry blossoms are fragile. They do not last long and easily break apart. High winds or a heavy rainstorm can knock them off the trees. That is why there are still a lot of springtime events planned to celebrate the ties between Japan and the United States. If you like things that fly high in the sky, there is the Blossom Kite Festival on April 1st and 2nd, and the National Cherry Blossom Festival Parade will take place on April 8th. I'm Dan Friedel.
The American Dictionary, Merriam-Webster, recently added a lot of new words to its online site. Learning English reporter Brian Lynn looked into the changes. He's joined me in the studio to talk about some of the new words. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ashley.
First off, how often does Merriam-Webster add words? Is this a yearly event?
No, actually it's not. The last time the company added new words online was 2014. But an editor-at-large, Peter Solokovsky, said Merriam-Webster had been watching some of the added words for many, many years. Others, he said, were much newer in use.
So where did they come from?
Everywhere, really. I mean, the new terms cover areas including science, technology, sports, pop culture. Most will probably be familiar to you.
Okay, so for example?
Well, how about the verb binge watch?
Oh, yes. I binge watch television shows sometimes. Always. That means to watch many episodes of a series in a short period of time. To binge, in this case, means to do a lot of something in a short amount of time.
Right. So in this case, I guess, watching one after the other for a few hours straight. Some people might watch a whole season of a show over a few days.
So here's another from the list you collected, Brian. Susian. Some Learning English fans outside America might not know this one.
Yeah, so Susian is an adjective that refers to the American children's book writer known as Dr. Seuss. He wrote these fantastical books for young children that included fun rhymes and colorful pictures.
Like Cat in the Hat and Green Eggs and Ham.
I will not eat them, Sam I Am. The books made you laugh, but they also helped a lot of kids learn to read. So anything that reminds a person of a Dr. Seuss world could be Seussian.
Okay. Green Eggs and Ham was the first book I ever read, actually. Another one on your list is Photobomb. That's when someone jumps in front of a camera uninvited. It's usually done as a joke. I've seen some pretty funny photos that were the result of a really good photobomb.
Right, yeah, photobombing is more of a prank. But, you know, it's not meant to throw shade on anyone.
Oh, so I guess that is another newly added phrase, to throw shade.
Yes, it is. So it's a slang expression that means to publicly express disrespect or dislike for someone. But to throw shade, the insult or offense has to be subtle or understated.
Okay, so among the new words are slang expressions as well.
Correct. So one of those is ghost.
We all know what that means as a noun, but...
Right, but as a verb, it means to abruptly cut off contact.
Mm-hmm. I have friends who have been quite hurt by people who have just ghosted on them without any explanation. It's not a very nice thing to do.
Right, so, I mean, with the slang words, you could even pile on top, right? You could throw shade and also ghost the same person.
Oh. Okay, so here is another word on this list. Microaggression. So is ghosting an example of microaggression?
Well, microaggression is a noun. It's a comment or action that subtly and often unconsciously or unintentionally expresses a prejudiced attitude toward a member of a minority group.
Okay, so that sounds a little more serious than ghosting.
It is.
All right, so this next word is not slang, and I'm not really sure most people know what this one means. Prosopagnosia.
Yes, so this is a noun, and it does have a scientific meaning. The inability to recognize faces.
Okay, so like a face blindness.
Exactly, that's what it would be, blind to faces.
Well, this has been really interesting, Brian. Thanks for joining me in studio here. And to our listeners, let us know if you liked this, and maybe we can do more of this in the future. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Now it's time for our program, American Stories. Here is the third and final part of The Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe.
I was visiting an old friend of mine, Roderick Usher, in his old stone house, his palace, where a feeling of death hung on the air. I saw how fear was pressing on his heart and mind. Now his only sister, the Lady Madeline, had died, and we had put her body in its resting place, in a room inside the cold walls of the palace, a damp, dark vault, a fearful place. As we looked down upon her face, I saw that there was a strong likeness between the two. Indeed, said Usher, we were born on the same day, and the tie between us has always been strong. We did not long look down at her, for fear and wonder filled our hearts. There was still a little color in her face, and there seemed to be a smile on her lips. We closed the heavy iron door and returned to the rooms above, which were hardly less gloomy than the vault. And now a change came in the sickness of my friend's mind. He went from room to room in a hurried step. His face was if possible, whiter and more ghastly than before, and the light in his eyes had gone. The trembling in his voice seemed to show the greatest fear. At times he sat looking at nothing for hours, as if listening to some sound I could not hear. I felt his condition slowly, but certainly, gaining power over me. I felt that his wild ideas were becoming fixed in my own mind. As I was going to bed late in the night of the 7th or 8th day after we placed the Lady Madeline within the vault, I experienced the full power of such feelings. Sleep did not come. While the hours passed, my mind fought against the nervousness. I tried to believe that much, if not all, of what I felt was due to the gloomy room, to the dark wall coverings which in a rising wind moved on the walls. But my efforts were useless. A trembling I could not stop filled my body, and fear without reason caught my heart. I sat up, looking into the darkness of my own room, listening, I do not know why, to certain low sounds which came when the storm was quiet. A feeling of horror lay upon me like a heavy weight. I put on my clothes and began walking nervously around the room. I had been walking for a very short time when I heard a light step coming toward my door. I knew it was Usher. In a moment I saw him at my door, as usual, very white, but there was a wild laugh in his eyes. Even so, I was glad to have his company.
"And have you not seen it?" he said.
He hurried to one of the windows and opened it to the storm. The force of the entering wind nearly lifted us from our feet. It was, indeed, a stormy but beautiful night, and wildly strange. The heavy, low-hanging clouds which seemed to press down upon the house flew from all directions against each other, always returning and never passing away in the distance. With their great thickness they cut off all light from the moon and the stars, but we could see them because they were lighted from below by the air itself, which we could see rising from the dark lake and from the stones of the house itself.
"You must not, you shall not look at this," I said to Usher, as I led him from the window to a seat. "This appearance, which surprises you so, has been seen in other places too. Perhaps the lake is the cause. Let us close this window. The air is cold. Here is one of the stories you like best. I will read, and you shall listen, and thus we will live through this fearful night together." The old book which I had picked up was one written by a fool for fools to read, and it was not, in truth, one that Usher liked. It was, however, the only one within easy reach. He seemed to listen quietly. Then I came to a part of the story in which a man, a strong man, full of wine, begins to break down a door, and the sound of the dry wood as it breaks can be heard through all the forest around him. Here I stopped, for it seemed to me that from some very distant part of the house sounds came to my ears like those of which I had been reading. Must have been this likeness that had made me notice them, for the sounds themselves, with the storm still increasing, were nothing to stop or interest me. I continued the story, and read how the man, now entering through the broken door, discovers a strange and terrible animal of the kind so often found in these old stories. He strikes it, and it falls with such a cry that he has to close his ears with his hands. Here again I stopped. There could be no doubt this time I did hear a distant sound,
very much like the cry of an animal in the story. I tried to control myself so that my friend would see nothing of what I felt. I was not certain that he had heard the sound, although he had clearly changed in some way. He had slowly moved his chair so that I could not see him well. I did see that his lips were moving as if he were speaking to himself. His head had dropped forward, but I knew he was not asleep, for his eyes were open, and he was moving his body from side to side. I began reading again and quickly came to a part of the story where a heavy piece of iron falls on a stone floor with a ringing sound. These words had just passed my lips when I heard clearly, but from far away, a loud ringing sound, as if something of iron had indeed fallen heavily upon a stone floor, or as if an iron door had closed. I lost control of myself completely and jumped up from my chair. Usher still sat moving a little from side to side. His eyes were turned to the floor. I rushed to his chair. As I placed my hand on his shoulder, I felt that his whole body was trembling. A sickly smile touched his lips. He spoke in a low, quick, and nervous voice as if he did not know I was there.
"Yes," he said, "I heard it. Many minutes, many hours, many days have I heard it. But I did not dare to speak. We have put her living in the vault. Did I not say that my senses were too strong? I heard her first movements many days ago, yet I did not dare to speak. And now that story. But the sounds were hers. Oh, where shall I run? She is coming to ask why I put her there too soon. I hear her footsteps on the stairs. I hear the heavy beating of her heart." Here he jumped up and cried as if he were giving up his soul. "I tell you, she now stands at the door!"
The great door to which he was pointing now slowly opened. It was the work of the rushing wind, perhaps, but no. Outside that door a shape did stand. The tall figure in its grave clothes of the Lady Madeline of Usher. There was blood upon her white dress, and the signs of her terrible efforts to escape were upon every part of her thin form. For a moment she remained trembling at the door. Then with a low cry she fell heavily in upon her brother. In her pain as she died at last, she carried him down with her, down to the floor. He too was dead, killed by his own fear. I rushed from the room. I rushed from the house. I ran. The storm was around me in all its strength as I crossed the bridge. Suddenly a wild light moved along the ground at my feet, and I turned to see where it could have come from, for only the great house and its darkness were behind me. The light was that of the full moon, of a blood-red moon, which was now shining through that break in the front wall. That crack which I thought I had seen when I first saw the palace, then only a little crack, it now widened as I watched. A strong wind came rushing over me, the whole face of the moon appeared. I saw the great walls falling apart. There was a long and stormy shouting sound, and the deep black lake closed darkly over all that remained of the House of Usher.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining us.